Let's talk about this plan of yours. I think it's good, except it sucks. So let me do the plan, and that way it might be really good.
Wow. Who's strong and brave here to save the American way?
Welcome to It's Good Except It Sucks, a movie-by-movie and television series-by-television series hurtled through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This time, we're taking a look at Captain America, The First Avenger, released in July 2011, when, if you preferred, you could have gone to see Ken Loach introducing his own BFI retrospective, Martin Scorsese's steampunk adventure drama Hugo, or Jennifer Aniston in Horrible Bosses instead. I'm Tim Worthington, and here's what I had to say about Captain America, The First Avenger when I live-tweeted my Marvel Cinematic Universe rewatch. The first proper masterpiece of the series, with not a single frame wasted and a thrilling story confidently told, with Red Skull more frightening than he ever was in the comics. Also, Hayley Atwell is magnificent. That's what I had to say about it, though. And joining me to give her thoughts on Captain America the First Avenger is film historian Melanie Williams. Melanie, where can people find you?
I teach film studies at the University of East Anglia, and I'm on their website and just generally out and about doing things.
Okay, so before we go any further, Melanie, what happens in Captain America the First Avenger?
We're introduced to the, I suppose, origin myth of Captain America, who is the First Avenger. The title gives us a clue as to that. It's about a kind of skinny American guy becoming completely buffed up into a major league superhero and doing lots of daring do and exciting stuff during World War II.
And as we'll come back to, I'd argue he's not even the star of the movie. But, Melanie, how much did you know about Captain America before you saw this?
Oh, not very much. This is where I have to make a shameful admission. I feel very on the back foot talking about Marvel films. Obviously, I teach film and I teach courses on Hollywood cinema, and a lot of the students I teach are very invested in Marvel films and the whole kind of Marvel cinematic universe, and I always feel a bit like a kind of slightly out of touch mum, I think increasingly so. So I'm aware that there's this whole cinematic universe that a lot of people are really invested in. However, it's something that slightly passed me by. So I've kind of seen the odd film. I'm kind of aware of the key stuff, but I feel like a complete fraud talking about any of this. It's almost a bit overwhelming. I sort of feel like it's passed me by and now I don't know where to start. So this was a nice kind of point of entry, I think.
Well, the interesting thing is that this technically, if you put everything, all the TV series and all the films in order chronologically, which some people out there have done, believe me, this actually technically comes first historically. So although it wasn't the first film, it's kind of an entry point because it sets up a lot of things that come back into it later. The really big thing is the Super Soldier program, which obviously is what turns Weedy Steve Rogers into Captain America. That plays a very big part later on in the films. It's why they changed, as we discussed in the one on the Hulk's origin story, so that Bruce Banner sort of participating in the Super Soldier program, or the modern day equivalent of it, was what made him into the Hulk. But it all goes back to this. And it's interesting, there's very little acknowledgement in it at the present at all. I think the most striking thing is, in the opening shot, because it starts in the present where they find Captain America sort of frozen in the ice after the end of the movie. And it's interesting that to get to this sort of kind of steampunk technology and this artificially enhanced man from the 40s, they use a very modern laser to cut through the ice. And I think that's the only concession you get to modernity in it, really.
If we're allowed spoilers as well, obviously the bit at the end where he's after his kind of Rip Van Winkle experience, when he kind of wakes up in the present day, or what I think is the present day, that sort of framing around it. And whenever anybody digs up anything dodgy from like an Arctic ice, you just think, have you not seen the thing? This is a really bad idea. If something's buried in ice, it's usually best to leave it there.
It's interesting as well. I was surprised when this came out that they actually acknowledge the original Captain America from the 40s at all, because it's something that's quite often skirted over, because there have not been that many attempts at doing Captain America either on television or in film, possibly because of this convoluted backstory. But there were a few, like there was the weird TV movies in the 70s where I think he's the nephew of Steve Rogers or something, and he has a magic motorbike, you know, kind of like a precursor to Street Hawk. They're not very good. There's been a couple of cartoons, and there's, as we'll come back to, there was a serial in the 40s, a Republic cinema serial based on the original Captain America, but generally they've tended to, because the Marvel thing when they brought him back in the 60s was, it was this same thing that he'd, you know, he'd been in suspended animation since the Second World War, he came back in the present, formed the Avengers, etc, etc. They did some stories initially set during World War II to kind of rewrite that backstory to fit the present. And a couple of things that spun out from that do turn up in this. But I really did think they'd start with a new Captain America, a present day one. But now it's the original one. And I think it works brilliantly. I think it's almost like a costume drama, but for the steampunk elements.
I think they do the sort of period detail really nicely. The kind of 1940s Brooklyn, but also 1940s London as well. It's done with real panache. And the bits where there are the kind of propaganda musical sequences, you can tell that somebody's watched their Betty Grable and their Busby Berkeley very closely, because it's a really smart image. Imitation of things like Pin-Up Girl that has exactly those kinds of flag-waving dance routines in it. I mean, that's always quite a good gateway for old fogies like me, if it's got some element of period drama. I mean, it doesn't have Judi Dench in, but at least it's got some nice kind of vintage styling that helped someone like me get into it.
It really hasn't, despite rumours the contrary. It wasn't done with CGI, and I can say that for absolute certainty, because there's a bit where when Hydrus steal the super soldier serum, and he, newly sort of woken up as Captain America, chases after them down the street, like jumping on the cars and so on, catching up with them. Halfway through that, I thought, that's the Stanley Dock in Liverpool. And I checked, and it is. It was all filmed in proper, authentic location.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Obviously, nowadays, you can create anything like that at the click of a mouse, almost.
Yeah.
Even to the trained eye, it generally looks real, but they have filmed that in real locations. I think some of it was shot in Manchester as well.
Yeah,
I found that really added to it, the fact that you do know that it's in a reality, if that makes sense.
This is where I can add some fascinating local knowledge, because the Avengers training camp is actually on my university campus. So the kind of big futuristic building where they all kind of do their training, that is the Sainsbury Centre, which is a big museum, which is on the University of East Anglia campus. It was quite exciting when they came to do the filming, and people got threatened to have their phones taken away permanently if they tried to snap Robert Downey Jr. getting changed. So that blending of kind of CGI but also real locations, I've seen that in operation, you know, just 5 minutes away from where I work. So that was quite thrilling.
Well, I don't know where they filmed the quote World Exposition of Tomorrow 1943. I suspect some of it was on the set, but some of it looks like it was outdoors. But you might not have spotted this, because I don't know whether you've seen any of the Iron Man films or not. That's run by Howard Stark, Tony Stark's father. And it's basically foreshadowing the big set pieces that Tony Stark does, you know, with the eyes of the world on him, dancing around in the Iron Man costume. And in this, he demonstrates a flying car, works for about 10 seconds, then falls to the ground. And he totally owns it with a joke about, we'll perfect it soon. And the thing is, that car then goes on to appear, not just in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., because Phil Coulson drives it at various points, but it's also in, this is the point where we have to talk about Peggy Carter, who is an absolutely brilliant character, and she then had her own two series, Agent Carter, in which Howard and the flying car and several other characters from this did appear. What did you make of Peggy? Because I think she's an astonishingly good character, even better here than she is in the comics.
Oh, well, Hayley Atwell's just incredibly beautiful, looks a picture in those kind of 40s fashions, from her uniform to these kind of crisp white blouses, trench coats, red siren dresses. She looks absolutely incredible, but also is a kind of nice, feisty character. There's that connection between her and Steve, which is not overplayed. And I thought there are several sequences where I think she's particularly effective. The bit towards the end when they're kind of on the radio together and this might be his final flight, I thought this is definitely a nod to A Matter of Life and Death, the Powell and Pressburger film, where you've got David Niven doing his kind of last speech to the radio operator who he falls in love with. I thought this is definitely a little kind of nod to those. It's kind of Anglo-American propaganda films from the 1940s. But she's absolutely pitch perfect in this and incredibly watchable. You can see exactly why there's so much potential for a kind of spin-off where she's quite enigmatic. You want to know more about this character, I think. So you can see why you'd want to kind of develop that at greater length.
Well, to me, she's the absolute standout character in this film. And I always love the way there's a balance between, as you say, they don't just make her a hard woman making it in a man's role, because she is allowed touches of femininity. There's the contrast between, you know, the way she punches a soldier out cold for sexually harassing her. When they're testing the Captain America shield, she just picks up a gun and fires 3 times point blank at it. And says, it's rather effective. But equally, there's the look she gives to nobody in particular when they're watching reconnaissance film of Captain America on a mission and she sees he has her photo in the locket.
Mm.
And it's a very kind of like, she doesn't let her guard down in front of the men there, but it's the way she plays it with her face. But also, it's a blink and you miss it moment, but when he emerges as Captain America, obviously with his shirt off after they've given him the super soldier serum, she actually for a second sort of touches his chest really curiously.
Yes,
and then asserts
herself.
I thought that was such a good touch, really. Without her having to drape herself over him or whatever, it just said a lot about the character.
Well, I suppose it's part of trying to get across that kind of mood being in period, you know, where obviously censorship of that time dictated that certain things had to be kind of alluded to or gestured in some kind of covert way rather than explicitly represented. So it's kind of in fitting with the kind of 1940s tone of it that it's quite restrained in that way.
Hayley Atwell said in an interview that she approached the role thinking of, sort of paraphrasing an old Ginger Rogers quote, she thought of Peggy as, she can do anything Captain America can do, but backwards in high heels. And I think that's absolutely spot on, really.
Yeah, I mean, that quote's such a gift, isn't it? It's brilliant. Yeah, I mean, that might be pushing it a bit far, given that she's not been kind of in the embuffening machine and turned into a kind of superhuman, but she certainly a very impressive woman who holds her own. The kind of banter with Tommy Lee Jones doing his really kind of gruff stuff really well. You've got to be pretty formidable to be able to not vanish into the background when you've got actors of that caliber doing their thing. And she does manage that.
Well, going back to the World Exposition, there are quite a few things referenced in this film where they are deep references for people who know their history. One of them is that the Expo's got the suit used by the original wartime Human Torch. That's in there. And there's very interesting things, like when you were alluding to the song and dance routine, and it's got kind of a montage, the rise of Captain America's popularity. It not only refers, it's got a remount of one of the episodes of the Republic serial.
Mm.
It's also got some of the original comics being sold by newspaper vendors as if to say they're part of continuity, which is really brain stretching. But the thing that's non-canonical that people don't really comment on about the World Exposition is Steve's date is played by Jenna Coleman about a year before she was in Doctor Who.
Oh, was that her? Because I thought, oh, she looks a bit like her, but I didn't actually.
Yes, no, it is actually it her. So she'd been in this massive film before the thing she's arguably best known for. Mm-hmm. I find that quite a weird turn of events that a character that wasn't universally popular, let's just put it that way, has eclipsed a character in one of the biggest films of the past decade.
Yeah. Natalie Dormer's, isn't she the girl that kisses him?
Yes,
when
yeah.
He's, yeah. So you kind of got these, like, through the casting, you've got these nods to these other massive media franchises going on at the same time. I think if you think about that stuff too much, it makes your head spin. But also, I mean, this is, again, where I feel really underqualified. Many of these things would just completely pass me by, particularly references forward, or they just elude me. The good thing about this film, I felt, is that I could watch it on its own terms without feeling like I wasn't getting it because I didn't get all the illusions. It worked as a film in and of itself, as well as a component of this much bigger cinematic universe. But it was like massively enjoyable without knowing about all the things that it's going to lead to and that it kind of interacts with. I do appreciate that. You know, I like a kind of good blockbuster experience where I'm not left feeling puzzled and confused and bewildered by not quite getting what's going on.
Well, that brings me round to one of my favourite observations about it, which is that, you know, you've got the battalion that are with him who were made, it's an amalgam of the Howling Commandos. So in the comics, they were the squadron with Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson. But in the comics, it was slightly different. He was a Second World War veteran who then joined S.H.I.E.L.D. It's them and Bucky Barnes, who was the sidekick in the original comics, in that he was younger than Steve Rogers. In this, I think he's supposed to be the same age, but he's bigger, he's smarter, he's not really a sidekick, he's more intellectually, he's very much an equal. But when they're escaping during that train heist, he falls from the train, apparently to his death. And I remember people gasping in the cinema because obviously this major character had apparently been killed off. And I'm sure there were people like me watching it thinking, oh my God, they're going to bring him back as the Winter Soldier. Because after about, seriously, about 60 years, Bucky was suddenly resurrected from nowhere as this mysterious agent, the Winter Soldier, who'd similarly been frozen in ice.
There's clearly a lot of it.
Yes, there is. But that's a perfect example of a reference that you didn't have to know about, which later became very important, because to anyone watching it, it's just a shock moment. But to anyone who knows it, it's a different kind of shock moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, without knowing the kind of implications or possibilities of that, it's still, you know, people going on a zip wire onto the back of a train that's moving. I mean, that's just exciting stuff, isn't it? Yeah, that dropping down into a chasm and not being able to quite get somebody before they fall. I mean, that's such a staple of suspense cinema. Hitchcock knew a thing or two about that kind of stuff, but it's, you know, it's handled really effectively, and I can imagine on a big screen that would be a kind of gasp worthy moment.
Well, speaking of the Winter Soldier, that brings me on to the film's treatment of the Nazis, which I think is quite interesting, because they're portrayed as they're not really aligned to the Nazi party anymore. They're part of Hydra, the substitute Nazis, basically, that dominate the first two phases of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, they've been a long-standing antagonist in the comics, where they've got the same aims, but even worse. They basically want to make everyone the same. But the two main protagonists in that, you've got Johann Schmidt, who becomes the Red Skull. He tries a super soldier formula on himself and becomes basically a Red Skull. You've also got Dr. Zola, played by Toby Jones, who later comes back in. He does appear in Agent Carter, as you don't know it at that point, he's posing as a member of S.H.I.E.L.D., but he's not, he's still aligned to Hydra. But he comes back in the Winter Soldier, having died years previously, as a computer that he uploaded to consciousness to in the 70s. I know that doesn't happen in this film, but the idea that you got these two, this disfigured freak, and somebody who just exists as code, wanting to implement the Master Race, that's quite a subtle way of ridiculing that aim. It isn't a typical way of dealing with Nazis in what's basically a period drama.
No, I mean, like you say, it's managing to sort of find an organisation worse than the Nazis, you know, with two-handed salutes instead of one is really, really going for it, I think. And Hugo Weaving is a terrific villain. There's a reason why he's perpetually cast in villainous roles, and it's because he's jolly good at being thoroughly evil. And the moment when he kind of removes his face, which again is such a fantastic thing to do if you're able to reveal the Red Skull. It's just fantastic stuff. Fiery pits, you know, that's kind of going on in the background. All the iconography you'd want. You know, it's no coincidence, I think, that Joe Johnston, the director of this, is involved in the special effects for Raiders of the Lost Ark, because clearly,
right, a kind
of melting Nazi face is a specialism of his. Toby Jones is interesting as well, because I was thinking at points his kind of German accent veered slightly into the territory of a low, a low, you know, felt a little bit kind of, you know, Gruber from a low, a low esque. But again, I mean, getting great British character actors to be Nazis in big, fantastic blockbuster films has a rich and long heritage, and Toby Jones is a fantastic inheritor of that. He's great. And I think also that idea of, you know, the kind of Nazi scientists being co-opted by the US is not mythology, it's historical fact. Werner von Braun, the Nazi scientist who masterminded the V2 rocket, was co-opted into NASA. So these things have their kind of historical analogies that they point towards, I think, subtly, but they're telling us something about geopolitics and identity without wanting to sound too film studies lecturer about this. But they are in and of themselves entertaining, but they're also gesturing towards these bigger questions, I think.
Well, that brings me around to an observation that I think needs to be made here about something else entirely, which is, weirdly, this character came up when you were on Looks Unfamiliar, which is there was a rumour going around last week about a Captain Britain film, which led a lot of people on Twitter, who obviously had no idea what they were talking about, no idea that Captain Britain is now a Muslim woman, but they were all saying, oh, I see, they're pandering to UKIP now, etc, etc. Now, Captain Britain was invented in the 70s, partly in response to the rise of the National Front, and at numerous points he fought the Red Skull. So I think he's on our side. Will we ever do a podcast without mentioning him? Or her, rather.
The thing about Captain America that I remember from my own youth is that there was a really crappy cartoon that used to get shown a lot. It was Captain America and his mighty shield, I think. And it's kind of put me off the whole character a bit.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield.
Well, on to the current Mighty Shield thrower, which is, we haven't really said much about Chris Evans. I think he is absolutely fantastic, because you can see the progression over the films from this, because in this he's a plucky but totally ineffectual kid who becomes this, well, super soldier. But waking up in the present, in the first couple of films he said he plays it as really confused. He doesn't quite get what's going on. All the pop culture references are lost on him. And he becomes more and more confident and comfortable with the present as they go on. To the extent that repeatedly in this one, he says to people, I can keep doing this all day. And in Endgame, when he confronts himself from the past when they're trying to get the Infinity Stones back, the past Captain America says, I can do this all day. And he says, yes, I know. Is a great way of sort of marking the character progression, but I really think he nails it. There's a quietness to his performance. It's not bombastic in any way.
No, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the film about what constitutes genuine heroism and courage and that sense of, you know, it being important that it's someone who's known weakness, so that when they are empowered physically, they'll kind of remember what it's like, or the kind of meaning of that power, whereas someone who's kind of always had that in their possession won't understand that in the same way. And I think his performance does convey that sense of bafflement, really, at what's changed physically and how that changes the way that he behaves and that he's responded to by other characters. I mean, it's quite nuanced. And again, thinking back to that kind of rubbishy cartoon with the lantern-jeweled guy with a shield just knocking seven bells out of whatever. Obviously, this is a world away from that. But I think in terms of that character development, and it's linked into the relationship with Agent Carter as well, you know, how he changes from Mr. Muscle to Marlon Brando, you know, from this kind of wimpy guy to, it's like the Charles Atlas adverts, you know, you too can have a body like mine, and you go from being the skinny guy that gets sand kicked in his face on the beach to the kind of big muscle-bound bodybuilder. I mean, the irony is, I think he's just as attractive when he's kind of skinny and wimpy as he is when he's all kind of buffed up, but he manages to kind of carry both of those things off quite charmingly, I think.
Well, we don't really get technically a post-credit scene in this. I mean, we do, but it's basically a cut-down scene from Avengers Assemble. But I actually think he plays the contrast well between what is the last scene of the film where he wakes up in the present, as you alluded to, he realises that the baseball game on the radio is one he was actually at. And so somebody's pulling his leg and he gets up and he realises it's the present. And he goes out and he sees all the digital advertising hoardings and looks confused. But then after the credits, it cuts to him basically demolishing a punch bag out of frustration. And then Nick Fury appears and he more or less says, "Have you got a mission for me, sir?" It's like he's starting to find his place in the present.
Yeah, is he just angry because he missed his date with Hayley Atwell? I mean,
I can sympathise with that.
I mean, I would be very angry. if that had happened. I mean, I think that exit line before the credits, "I had a date," is a really smart like little comment to end on as well.
Well, that brings me on to the last thing I have to ask, which is, Melanie, if you had the ability to do anything Captain America can do but backwards in high heels, what would you use it for?
Well, I've been putting up some shelves, so I think Captain America's strength would be quite useful for that, really. DIY mainly.
Melanie, it's been brilliant. Thank you, and Excelsior.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed this, don't forget you can find more editions of It's Good Except It Sucks and details of my book Can't Help Thinking About Me at timworthington.org.